Tonight on Arena, Alex Murphy and Catherine Walsh in Philadelphia, Here I Come at the Cork Opera House, and Stuart Neville is writing in his own accent in his new novel, The House of Ashes. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Alex Murphy, TV's young offender, takes to the stage next week at the Cork Opera House, where he plays Gar Private in Philadelphia, Here I Come, the play that first made Brian Friel's name as a writer. Jeff Gould directs this story of young Gar O'Donnell, who, on the eve of emigrating to the United States, is railing against the frustrations of life in Ballybeg, but only in his thoughts, of course, not where anyone can actually hear him. The cast includes Catherine Walsh as Madge, Seamus O'Rourke as Gar's dad, S.B. O'Donnell, and Megan McDonald as Katie Dugan. Delighted to be joined now by Alex Murphy, Catherine Walsh and Jeff Gould from Cork. Alex, just from each, but I'll start with you, Alex. What was your first connection, or what is your connection with Philadelphia, Here I Come? When did you first come across it? Do you know it for a while?
It's kind of just a play. If you're involved in acting in any way growing up, you know about Philadelphia, Here I Come, because they're kind of dream parts, being public or private Gar for me anyway. So to be playing that right now is a bit of a dream come true. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for giving me the part. This is terrible. I think I studied it in junior cert, but it was so long ago now. I can't tell you that for certain. But growing up, you're kind of told Brian Friel is an amazing writer, and you take that as the truth. But I feel like working on this now, and working with people like Jeff and Catherine, who have such an extensive knowledge of Brian Friel, I've grown to appreciate him a lot more than I had done. I can really just see his genius kind of in the writing. It's just been such a pleasure of a job, really, so
and
far.
On the specifics of Gar Private, who, of course, he's the one who's giving voice to all the internal thoughts of Gar Public, or certainly prodding Gar Public in some ways as well. How would you describe that character and what you get to do as that character?
So my character is the internal thoughts of Gareth O'Donnell. So everything he thinks or the things he wants to say, I'm the one who actually says them out loud. So if he's sitting at a dinner table, I'm saying the things to his father that he's too scared or embarrassed really to say to him, which is such a great tool for Friel to use, especially like it was revolutionary for its time and it's never done before. That's me really. I speak the thoughts.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now because we know Philadelphia, Here I Come, but it was so revolutionary at the time. And Catherine Walsh, this is a play with which you have a fairly long history as well, Catherine, going right back to, I suppose, studying it at school. I know you did it there and probably you saw it in the Father Matthew Hall in Cork. But I want to talk about your association with it as an actor. 1992, yeah. You were in New York. Very different part that you were thinking about at that time.
Yeah. Well, I was actually watching Joe Dowling's production of it. It was the dress rehearsal, and he knew that there was a few Irish actors living in New York at the time. And so he said, come along. So I went along and watched the dress rehearsal. And the girl who was playing Kate, she was fine, but her understudy, she collapsed and she was gone. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, Catherine, would you like to understudy it? So the production was going on and opening, and I went into understudy. Now, I never got to go on, so I don't feel I was ever part of it. I was busily being a bad waitress over in Brooklyn, and I'd ring in at 5:30 every night and say, am I needed? But I was never needed. I remember it. I can hear it in my head, and I can hear the music. It's the music that stayed with me.
Yeah,
that,
of course.
That is... Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't dictate. He suggests and tells the precise pieces of music that Gar is listening to. At one point, there's a speech over the violin concerto, and every syllable is timed with the music itself. The music is hugely important. But you were understudying Kate back then, and she is the young paramour, I suppose, the young one that Gar has his eye on, but can never get near. But not the part you're playing for sure this time, Madge,
No. Yeah, 30 years later, Sean, now...
You might be a little bit beyond kid.
Mother.
Yes. Madge, it's an extraordinary role. There's more to this than a housekeeper in a house. How would you describe her?
I really do feel like she's a surrogate mother. Now, I'm very much aware that she's the housekeeper and SB is the father of Gar. But he has climbed into my heart and that's how I see him. So I see it very much like a surrogate mother, even though I'm aware that he's not my son.
Yeah, of course. But Gar's mother died when he was very young. So yes, he's been brought up essentially by SB, and Madge has, as you say,
as the housekeeper,
been that surrogate mother for him. Coming to you then, Jeff, obviously people have connections to this play. If you're, as Alex said to us, if you're involved in theatre in any way, you're going to probably remember details about this play and first encounters with it. You've always wanted to direct it.
Yeah, I mean, it was never on my leaving cert, that's for sure. I'm way older than those two. So I saw it in 91 in the Cork Opera House. Jerry Burns did a production of it with Mary Elizabeth Burke Kennedy directing. And it was just stunning. Sean McCarthy, who was the scriptwriter for Glen Rowe, played Screwballs, and they had two fantastic gars in Peter Fitzgerald and Dan Millan. And it just left a lasting impression. It's just one of those plays that does.
Yeah, and it's a play that's been there since 1960, so we're talking over a half a century old. Why do you think it has endured? Because you might think this is a story of emigration set in the 1950s, I suppose, essentially, or possibly early 1960s. That's an old story now, but this play seems to go beyond that.
Yeah, well, I suppose great plays endure forever, and the reason they do is that they resonate with audiences of every generation, past and future. The brilliant academician Christopher Murray makes the point that great Irish plays provide a mirror up the nation, and Philadelphia continues to do that. Back in the day, in 64, that mirror was probably against the patriarchal society that existed at the time. So you kind of have, you have the canon representing the church, and he's a bit decrepit, and you have a drunken master representing education, and then you have the counsellor who can't communicate with anyone representing politics. But nowadays, I think it's relevant because it's about communication. You know, it's always been said it's a father-son play, but I never really saw it as that. You know, if you can have a husband and wife sitting across the table having the same difficulty that a father and a son would have, or a brother and a sister would have, and I think that's why it's incredibly relevant to a modern audience.
I think too, Alex, Alex Murphy playing the character of Gar Private, I wonder to what extent can Gar Private, I've often wondered about this, can he become involved in the emotions that Gar Public is going through? For example, when Gar Public is watching Madge and you're saying to him, watch every step and watch every move of that woman as she moves away. You're going to remember this. This will be etched on your brain forever. And even as I say it now, I find myself becoming emotional about it because it's so packed with emotion, this play. Can Gar Private allow himself to be involved in Gar Public's emotions?
Definitely, because you go through your daily life, and you if you have a job to do, you might be feeling certain things that you're not allowed to show or it's not appropriate to show. But in moments like that, where the night before he's flying off, I'm telling him, stop now and watch Madge, because you won't be able to watch her for the next few years. Because if going to Philadelphia back then isn't like going to Philadelphia now, where if you're sick of it, you can come home next Thursday. When you're gone, you are gone for the foreseeable, really.
Yeah.
But with regards to getting emotional, yes, he feels sadness and anger like everyone else, but he's not great at showing it. So as my character, I'm allowed to show it because I am raw emotion, really.
Yeah.
He can't hide how he feels. He can hide how he looks.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a scene actually that might give us a sense of the way in which, as Gar Private, you get to comment on what's in front of you. At this stage, Screwballs, as Gar calls S.B. O'Donnell, and Canon Byrne are in the house. They're probably playing cards, I think, at this stage. They have their weekly date playing cards. And Gar Private is looking over at them. And this is you, Alex, in that particular situation.
Let's chat about what? No, Screwballs, not women, not before you know who. Money! Sure, what interest have you in money? Sure, as long as you get to Tenerife for 5 weeks every winter, what interest have you in money? But I'm wasting my time with you, Canon. Screwballs here is different. There's an affinity between Screwballs and me that no one, literally no one, could understand. Except you, Canon. Because you're warm and kind and soft and sympathetic, all things to all men. Because you could translate all this loneliness, this groping, this dreadful bloody buffoonery into Christian terms that will make life bearable for us all. And yet you don't say a word. Why, Canon? Why, arid Canon? Isn't this your job? To translate?
There we go. That's Alex Murphy as Gar Private in upcoming production of Philadelphia, Here I Come at the Cork Opera House. Alex is with me on the programme this evening, along with Catherine Walsh, who's playing the character of Madge, and Jeff Gould, who is directing the production. I believe you have familial connections that helped you with the accent, or certainly are going to check out your accent on this one, Alex.
I know, yeah. I don't know whether they're going to help or are they just coming and judging me. A bit of both. But yeah, my mum's from Donegal in a show on the very top. So I have a lot of cousins and aunties and uncles, and they'll be making, a few of them will make the trip down. So yeah, I've grown up around the accent, so it's definitely helped.
Yeah, and would you have spent time there as a child? Would you have been aware of that accent? I mean, it's a very different accent from your own natural accent, or indeed the accent of Connor in Young Offenders.
Yeah, well, it's north, the polar opposites, literally. But yeah, I went to Donegal every summer all the way through my childhood and into my teenage years, so I'm pretty familiar with it. See, but it's making it sound kind of natural.
Yeah, you've been getting ready to play Gar Private obviously for years then. And on the subject of Connor, the other thing which must have given you great relief was to get to grow your hair a little bit. It's a very different look. Sorry, say that again.
My mother's delighted about that. Finally people will see me with long hair.
Yes, it is for sure a very different look. Do you see any connection between the two characters, or is it actually just a welcome opportunity to put Conor McSweeney to the one side?
It's a funny one, because I mean, The Young Offenders is in people's homes, and if people are watching it, it's part of their current day. But I haven't filmed that in over 2 years now, so it's really not a part. It's not in my head at all. So this is just a great opportunity just to get back to work. And especially doing a play with real people in a real room, because of the past 2 years that's been in this.
Yeah.
But with regards to kind of Connor and Gar, not a whole lot of similarities now. Gar is very, he wouldn't be out stealing bikes now. He's too much of a wimp.
No, I don't think he'd be at that right enough. The other aspect of this, and never mind COVID at all in this discussion, Jeff, a cast of 14, you quite simply don't get plays for big casts in much of today's writing. What kind of challenges does that put on you, and why do you think it is that we get much smaller casts nowadays?
Lance, your first question first. Yeah, it is a bit of a challenge from the point of view of actually just dealing with 14 good minds coming at you and asking you loads of questions. I'm the king of one-hander plays. I've probably done more than anybody in the world. So there's just one person asking you a question. When there's 14 of them asking you a question, and they don't suffer fools this cast. The pressure is on all day. So that's the first problem. I suppose the reason they're not, I mean, the cost of it really, Sean, 14 actors, you know, 4 weeks rehearsal, nobody can afford it. And unfortunately, I have to say the Arts Council have been incredibly supportive this year to us while we've been out, but I would love to see a ring fence funding for classics. They're just not as cool anymore as a lot of the stuff that's coming out, and it would be lovely to have that down the line. You know?
Just one other question I wanted to ask Alex, just before we wrap up, Alex, it's about the Gar Public character. Who's playing Gar Public, and how important is the kind of chemistry between you, Gar Public and Gar Private, the two actors, for the playing of this role?
Shane O'Regan, who's from Dublin, he's playing Gar Public, and it's very important, and luckily we get on like a house on fire, and he's great to work with. It's just trying to find that thing of we are both playing the same character. It's hard to hammer that home when you're in the rehearsal room.
Because
you'd never give another actor a note, but it's something that when you're both playing Gar, just different mindsets of Gar, you can't afford to give your ideas to Shane or him to me, and it's just trying to work out the best way to do this, because we are a bit of a double act.
Yeah.
It's about being quite vocal with each other about how you're feeling in the scene or just ideas, and making sure you're both on the same page. And if you're not, maybe that's good too, because your actions don't always match your thoughts.
Yeah, sometimes it's right to be on different pages in the case of GAR Public and GAR Private. Well, listen, thanks to all three of you for speaking with me this evening. That's Alex Murphy playing the character of GAR Private, Catherine Walsh playing the character of Madge, and Jeff Gould, who is directing that new production of Philadelphia Here I Come from Pat Talbot Productions. It's at the Cork Opera House from the 5th of October through until the 16th, and you'll get further details at corkoperahouse.ie. Let me also tell you, Seamus O'Rourke is playing that, and Marco Regan is playing the Canon. It really is a super cast, and it sounds like a production well worth seeing. 22 minutes past seven on Wednesday night's Arena. Everyone has their favourite Bond, whether it's the rugged Sean Connery, suave Roger Moore, smooth Pierce Brosnan, angst-ridden Timothy Dalton, or largely forgotten George Lazenby. No Time to Die will be Daniel Craig's last appearance as 007, but it's his portrayal of the secret agent. Is it, in fact, the closest representation of the original character as created by Ian Fleming? The 25th James Bond premiered last night. We'll be reviewing it in full tomorrow night. But with me this evening is Paul Whittington. We're going to take a look back at the five films that Daniel Craig has been in as 007 and what he's done with the character and where he has brought to with No Time to Die, the film, Paul. But I suppose it... If we go back to when Daniel Craig took over the role, what state was the franchise in at that point?
Well, it was in a pretty perilous state, really, Sean, because although Pierce Brosnan was quite popular, and the Dino of the Day, his last film, it did okay at the box office quite well, actually, but those films never quite escaped the kind of campness that had afflicted the whole thing since Roger Moore, and people are fond of Roger Moore and his sense of humour and everything, but they became impossible to take seriously. And in fact, after Die Another Day came out, Roger Moore was moved to comment and said, you know, and he said, speaking as, you know, the first Bond in space, they've gone too far, invisible cars, you know, play, and so it had just become ridiculous. And the brilliant, very clever thing that two writers, Robert Wade and Neil Purvis, and Daniel Craig, when he came on board, and the director Martin Campbell did, was do a back to basic story where Bond is young and impetuous and a kind of, you know, a kind of out of control weapon, and that allowed them to completely reinvent the whole thing.
Yeah, and that was Casino Royale. Now, in that particular story, if we think of where Daniel Craig was coming from as an actor, he was coming from a very different place than any of the Bonds really that had preceded him.
He was, and he was met with the barrage of online abuse as well, and in fact he avoids social media perhaps as a consequence of that, he doesn't use it, but he was an indie actor. He'd been in things like Layer Cake, and I think Our Friends in the North, he was in as well, and he was quite a serious indie actor. People complained that he was too short because he's 5'10". He's not that short, that's considered too short. He was blonde, forgetting that Roger Moore was also blonde. They just couldn't stand him. He was weedy, which is ridiculous when you consider what happened next. But he just kind of switched off. He thought, I actually spoke to him last week, and he just said, listen, I can't listen to all that. This could be a one-off. It might be a failure, but I'm just going to do my best.
Yeah. Casino Royale. Then, what was the setup here, and what did he do with Bond as he brought the character to the screen in this?
I think it's actually the best of all the Bond films. I really do, and I might not be alone in that. I think it's better than any of the others. And what he did was, as I mentioned, he is this young Bond, M, Judi Dench's M, who is so important in the success
later
of these films. She describes him as a blunt instrument, and you know he makes mistakes. He kills people. He also falls in love, which people won't associate with Bond, with Vesper Lynn, David Green's character. So he is this impetuous character. He's a human character. His orphaned state is referred to. That will become important as things. He's given a backstory, and what Craig managed to do was give him three dimensions and make him possible to engage with.
Let's listen to a clip from Casino Royale. Now, he's on this assignment. He's trying to bankrupt a terrorist financier called Le Chiffre. This is the Mads Mikkelsen character.
Yes.
And the high-stakes poker game is what's going to be involved, hence Casino Royale and the title. Now, he meets a Treasury employee. This is the Eva Green character, Vesper Lynd, and she's assigned to provide the money he needs for the game. And listen to this conversation, a man and a woman, the man being Bond and the woman up to this point would always have been referred to as a Bond girl. This is a very different type of interaction.
So you're telling me it's a matter of probability and odds? I was worried there was some chance involved.
Well, any of you seen the play with the best damn wind?
So that will be what you call bluffing.
You've heard the term. Then you're also another in poker. You never play your hand. You play the man across from you.
And you're good at reading people.
Yes, I am. Which is why I've been able to detect an undercurrent of sarcasm in your voice.
You'll know how short our money is in good hands.
You don't think this is a very good plan, do you?
So there is a plan. I got the impression we were risking millions of dollars and hundreds of lives on a game of luck. What else can you surmise, Mr. Bond?
About you, Miss Lind? Well, your beauty's a problem. You worry you won't be taken seriously.
Which one can say of any attractive woman with half a brain?
True, but this one overcompensates by wearing slightly masculine clothing, being more aggressive than her female colleagues, which gives her a somewhat prickly demeanor. And ironically enough, makes it less likely for her to be accepted and promoted by her male superiors, who mistake her insecurities for arrogance. Now, I'd have normally gone with only child, but, you see, by the way you ignored the quip about your parents, I'm going to have to go with orphan.
And that's Daniel Craig in his first appearance as Bond in Casino Royale, and Eva Green as Vesper Linde also in that scene. Paul Whittington, looking back on what Daniel Craig has done with Bond over the five films that he's been involved in the role. I was saying as we were listening to that, Paul, yeah, there's a chemistry there. Yeah, there's a fizz there.
Mm.
But there's no, you know, there's no smart innuendo. There's no double entendre at all.
No.
He's taking the woman opposite him very seriously in a way that hadn't been done previous to that.
That's very true. And that would evolve through the five films. He doesn't, I mean, if you're going back to Sean Connery as Bond, who, as the director of this one, the new one pointed out, he had a very slender understanding of the principle of consent, never mind anything else, whereas this is entirely different. He's not running after every woman he sees. He treats Vesper Linde as an equal straight away, as you mentioned. And he's just not, that whole kind of predatory thing is kind of gone.
Yeah, so that was the first of the films. And the reaction, yes, there was that initial, oh, he's too,
yes,
he's too blonde, he's too small, he's too, all of those things.
Yeah.
Did people begin to warm to him as the movies moved on then? From
I think I think that there was a sort of shock at how good Casino Royale was, because it was a very fine film. It was a long film. It was a big, you know, blockbuster film. And it had to do what all Bond films had to do. It had to have gadgets. It had to have attractive female people in it. It had to have, you know, hand-to-hand combat and everything. But it did all those things and yet managed to do much more with the character. And to bring him on and develop and crucial to that was this kind of mammy relationship that he had with them.
Yeah, now, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Skyfall, you don't want to listen to this next bit of the conversation.
No.
If you have seen Skyfall, you know what we're about to talk about.
Yeah.
Judi Dench and Daniel Craig, now, she had been in the Bond films up to this, but something new happened here, didn't
it? Yeah,
didn't
absolutely. She was in the Pierce Brosnan films. I think she started around 1995, but something totally different because Craig was so much younger than her. She developed this kind of, you know, schoolmarmish, mammy approach to him, and she just was exasperated with him all the time, and much humour came from that. And you could see that her opinion of him mattered to him. So this, they really had great play with this. And obviously there was Quantum, which everybody...
Quantum of Solace, yeah.
Even Daniel Craig said last week, it's a bit of a mess. It's a hot mess, he said. But it's better than some Bond films. But in Skyfall, which I think was really enjoyable...
And Sam Mendes was on board as director here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they brought that relationship to its fruition.
Really. Yeah, well, I gave the spoiler alert. M, played by Judi Dench, has just been shot. And this scene is going to end very sadly
for
both her, and indeed you'll hear how sad the Daniel Craig character is as well. This scene from Skyfall.
007, what took you so long?
Well, I got into some deep water.
Get one thing right.
And that's Judi Dench as M, her final appearance as M in Skyfall.
Yeah.
Paul Whittington with me tonight looking at what Daniel Craig has done for the Bond films over the five films that he's been involved in, which brings us to No Time to Die. You saw it last night and we won't review it in full, but I do want you to talk a little bit about, you know, what he started in that first, in Casino Royale, what the character that he set out to make, this more real person that we could kind of sympathise with and empathise with rather than the suave, you know, sophisticated. How has he completed that character arc in No Time to Die?
Well, through the last film, Spectre, and now this one, he the love story with Vesper Lynd was really a way of explaining, you know, his kind of you know, his toughness and his unhappiness. But he now has a new love interest in Lea Seydoux's character, who happily is a psychiatrist because he probably needs one. But that relationship again is developed further in this, and in a way he comes full circle as a kind of human being in this, as opposed to just a machine. All the other elements are there in the film, all the big, you know, the big chases, and there's some great set pieces, but it's really about the human being at the centre of it, and he's very, very good at it, I have to say.
Here's a clip of Daniel Craig meeting a new 00 operative. This is Nomi, played by Lashana Lynch, and they're in a bedroom here, I think, in this scene.
They are, I'm afraid, Sean, yeah.
Yeah, they are in a bedroom, but this is a very different James Bond, so this is the conversation that happens in a bedroom with Daniel Craig as Bond.
Shall we cut to the chase?
I'm here as a professional courtesy.
Well, you're not very courteous, are you? You've broken my car. It's Commander Bond. You know that. 00?
2 years.
Very young.
High achiever.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The world's moved on since he retired, Commander Bond. Perhaps he didn't notice.
No, can't say I had. And in my humble opinion, the world doesn't change very much.
You had to say that. Look, this all seems like heaven. This little bubble, or whatever. But it's so obvious you're a man who only has time to kill. Nothing to live for.
No Time to Die there from, rather, Daniel Craig and Lashana Lynch in No Time to Die. Paul Whittington with me this evening. So what has he done and how has he done Daniel Craig in this new movie, Paul?
As I say, he has in a way brought the character full circle. He's very, very good in it, because obviously he has all the usual stuff to do. He broke his ankle or something in this film, as he always does. But there's a real kind of gravitas to the way he ends the film, and to his interactions there with, she's been given his number 007, and he says it's just a number, but he looks hurt. But he's kind of trying to move on from all that. And I think he's really, really good in it. Given the limitations of an action film, I think he's excellent.
And if you compare the scene that we got from Casino Royale, and it kind of, he's almost tentative in the way he's approaching that conversation. He's so much more commanding in that final scene there.
Yeah, he's made it his own. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you're recommending this from the Daniel Craig point of view, for sure.
Yes, I'm not allowed to give stars, but I certainly am recommending it.
We'll be giving the stars out tomorrow night, but I'm dying to see it on the basis of what you've been telling me. That's Paul Whittington talking to us about No Time to Die and Daniel Craig's development of the role of 007. My next guest is writer Stuart Neville, just published his new novel, The House of Ashes. Stuart is best known for The 12, which is called The Ghosts of Belfast in America. And as with that novel, The House of Ashes shows how a violent past cannot lie dormant, as the cries of vengeance from the past cannot be ignored. The House of Ashes takes us into the heart of rural Northern Ireland with Sarah and Damien, a couple who have just moved into an old house. And boy, does that house have a terrible and blood-soaked history. Delighted to have Stuart Neville join me on the programme this evening. Just to get the setup of what's involved here, tell us a little bit about Sarah and Damien. And I suppose it's mostly Sarah that we're dealing with. It's kind of her story that you're concentrating on, Stuart. Her situation moving to this rural Northern Ireland house in contemporary times.
Thank you for having me here tonight. The novel opens with Sarah, her point of view, and we learn very quickly that she has moved to Northern Ireland with her husband, Damon, who's from that area. She's from Bath originally in England. And we learn that it's referred to as some sort of nervous incident or nervous breakdown that she's had that has prompted her husband to move them to Northern Ireland to sort of get her away from things. But as the story develops, we realise that it's not quite as healthy a relationship as that, in that it's more to do with him keeping her isolated and controlled than this to do with helping her. And as part of that, he moves her to this remote house that was almost destroyed in a fire, and his father-in-law, a property developer, has basically rebuilt as a gift to them. But she's, you know, in the first days in this house, she realizes something's not quite right. Yeah. And for example, she keeps finding red stains on the kitchen floor that no matter how many times she cleans them away, they come back. And then on the third or fourth morning in the house, there's a hammering on the door, and an elderly lady is there, bloodied and disheveled. I don't know why Sarah's in her house and what she's done with her children.
Yeah, so she's talking about
things spiral from there.
Yeah, and that character who arrives, we will learn more about her as time goes on. But essentially, there are two stories running side by side, but we're quite definitely in Northern Ireland. We're quite definitely in rural Northern Ireland in this book. Had you been either avoiding Northern Ireland for a while, or had you been trying to just get out of it for a while? Because it has been a while since you've set something in the province itself.
Yeah, I mean, the last two books I wrote under a pen name, Hale and Beck, were both set in the States. Partly done for commercial reasons, trying to shift to form a few more books possibly, but also just I wanted to break from writing about here, just a change of scenery. But as my friend John Connolly has said, every book you write is a reaction to the last. And so this book, having written a couple of books set in the States, this book is probably the most Northern Irish book I've written. In all sorts of respects, not least of which is the language. I mean, it's written, a large part of the book is written with an accent, which I don't normally do. I haven't done before. But this story felt like the right one to try it with.
Had you been avoiding doing the accent? Why would you not go into that? Because it's such a colourful... I know I'm from just down the road, so I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think people in that part of the world have a very colourful way of expressing themselves in a kind of Hiberno English, Ulster Scots way.
Yeah, it's... I'd always kept the books quite neutral, and they had been set in Belfast for the most part, but as the books have gone on, they've moved further and further from Belfast out into the more rural areas. And I'd been struggling to write this book. I was having real problems with it. I'd been working on it since about 2016. I couldn't quite get it to gel. And I read a book by an old friend of mine called Michael Hughes, a novel called Country. That was sounds very strange, but it's a retelling of the Iliad set around the Irish borderlands around the end of the Troubles. And the entire book is written in a sort of Northern Irish rural vernacular, that sort of Ulster Scots dialect. And I was reading that and I thought, that's what I need. That's the key to this. And a large part of The House of Ashes is told from the point of view of Mary, recounting what happened to her in the house 60 years before Sarah arrived there.
Yeah.
Well, and her voice in the book is that accented voice with the dialect and the sort of the local language. And again, I was reading Country by Michael Hughes that made me realise, you know, there was a way to do this and still be readable.
Yeah,
for people who aren't necessarily familiar with it.
Yeah, would you read a little section of Mary? And Mary Mary who's narrating to us here is a very young person, a child, effectively, as she is narrating to us. That's what we feel as we're listening.
Yeah, when we first meet her, Mary's an elderly lady, but it jumps back in time to her point of view as a child around 11 years old or so. But this is her first chapter, and it starts with a line I ripped shamelessly off the Michael Hughes book. It starts like this. Here now, I'll tell you. I don't mind what age I was the first time they let me up the stairs by my own self. 5, maybe, or 6. Old enough that I could do a lock of wee things around the place. Sweeping up the floors, dumping out the ashes from the fireplaces. Mummy Noreen told me what to do. Says she, when the daddies around, you don't look at them. Just you get on with your work. Just pretend you aren't there and there. And they'll not bother with you. Unless they do bother with you. Then you be polite and don't give them any cheek. So that's what I did. I just bit on with what I had to do. And if Daddy George or Daddy Ivan came in, I just put my head down and said nothing. And that wasn't hard to do either. I was wild afeard of them. They weren't so about giving beatings them boys. Any time Mummy Noreen or Mummy Joy would have a black eye or a sore back from a kicking. Daddy Tam was the worst of them. He was a crib of their skitter, so he was. He slapped you as soon as look at you. And then big hands of his. If he hit you, you knew you were hit.
And that's Stuart Neville reading from his new novel, The House of Ashes. And the narrator there, Mary, as an 11-year-old child, talking about... the language is extraordinary, Stuart, and it is great to hear you read it in its own accent. But we can't shy away from the sort of things that she's talking about here as well. She talks about three daddies. She talks about Daddy Tam, Daddy George, Daddy Ivan, none of whom I want to meet ever. And she also talks about Mummy Joy and Mummy Noreen. What is the setup in the house that she is describing to us?
Yeah, so 60 years in the past, Mary has been living all her life, all her 10 or 11 years in the basement of this house, this dugout basement underneath this house, along with two women that she knows as Mummy Joy and Mummy Noreen. She suspects that maybe Mummy Joy is her real mummy, but she's not sure. Nobody's ever told her. And they spend their days looking after, in various ways, the three men who live upstairs. There's Daddy Ivan, who's the Sir Patriarch, and his two sons, Tam and George. And
well, what I want to get at, really, in terms of what's going on in the house at that time, is the absolute terror that is there, the violence that is there, the threat of violence that is there all the time. It is not a pleasant place to be. How difficult, first of all, is it to write about that type of darkness?
Well, the first thing is I don't actually tend to dwell on the violence itself. We know, as the reader understands, what the setup is very quickly and what the threat is. But the narrative, apart from specific moments, doesn't really dwell on that in itself. It tends to dwell more on the relationships between the women that are in the house. But yes, it is an abusive situation. Those women are held captive. And there's that threat of violence constantly hanging over them. And then, you know, and the three men, they're quite different personalities. Ivan's a very strict patriarch, very stern, and has a belt about his waist that will come off when it needs to, to deal out punishments. There's Tam, who's more unstable, a more angry man. Then there's George, who's the soft one of them, as the story goes on. But yeah, this threat of these men is constantly there, but the story is more interested in how the women navigate that.
And the other, and that is paralleled.
Find a way out of it.
Yeah, and that is paralleled by the situation that our character Sarah finds herself in contemporary Northern Ireland, in that same house. Obviously, coercive control was something you wanted to write about here. Why was that so important to you, and how did you want to approach that? You're coming at it as a man writing about a situation that these women find themselves in.
Yeah, it's. Again, a similar approach to the story set in the past, that I didn't want to dwell on suffering in the story, because I know my books have been known for a good amount of violence and so on, but suffering isn't something that I like to sort of linger on too much. It tends to be more the aftermath or the anticipation of violence rather than the violence itself. And with Sarah and Damien's relationship, it isn't actually in itself a violent relationship, but it's more about control. He has worked very hard to isolate her from her friends and her family. She has no money of her own. She has no transport. She can't leave the house without him, basically. And it's the sense of isolation. I talked to a couple of them who I'd known and been in those situations and read a bit, and you know, similar themes kept coming up of the constant uncertainty of the ground always being unsteady beneath her feet. I've never, ever been able to quite settle.
Yeah.
And for fear they might upset somebody.
And it strikes me that you're writing about it 60 years ago and you're writing about it today. Is it a case that, you know, plus ça change?
Yeah, I mean, they're two quite different extremes of the same kind of toxic masculinity, I guess, that of abusive men. You know, the situation Sarah finds herself in is far too common. It's that many people might recognize that situation as they read it. The situation Mary found herself in 60 years ago obviously is far more extreme, but we know has happened as well.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for speaking to us about the novel this evening. That's Stuart Neville. And the new novel is called The House of Ashes, published by Soho Press. New EP out from Loa. It's called When I Rise Up. And this is the title track.
When I rise up above the earth and look down on the things that fetter me, when I rise up above the earth and look down on the things that fetter me, I beat my wings upon the air. I beat my wings upon the air. I beat my wings upon the air, or tranquilize.
That's When I Rise Up, a title track from the new EP from Loa, an EP that features works by several poets, set to music by Loa. And on the basis of that, I certainly want to hear more of When I Rise Up. The writer Annie Ernaux is considered the great chronicler of French society. The English language publication of her book The Years by Fitzcarraldo Editions in 2019 brought her writing to a whole new audience. The work was nominated for the International Booker. Ernaux's deceptively simple writing style and her focus on women and class have garnered her quite a serious fan base. And there's a debate as to whether she is the preeminent practitioner of the so-called autofiction genre, a title that she actively resists. Now, another of her books, Exteriors, has been published in translation. It chronicles life in a newly built Paris suburb over a seven-year period from 1985 to 1992, taking the form of diary entries and sometimes just brief notes. Idel Coffey has been reading it for us. She joins me now from our Galway studio. Tell me a little bit more about Annie Ernaux, extraordinary place really she has in French society, Idel.
Yes, she does. She's kind of a living legend there at this stage now. She's 81 and, you know, she kind of worked hard to earn that status in what she describes as a very sort of misogynistic literary environment in France, where the prizes were given by men to men mostly. And she's kind of just determinedly kept working through that. And finally, after the publication of what is considered her sort of defining work, which is called The Years, the one you mentioned there that was nominated for the International Booker, that kind of changed things for her, because it was like this, almost like an autobiography, not only of her own life, but of post-war France, essentially, over the course of 60 years. So it was an incredible achievement. Yeah. And thankfully, she was kind of acknowledged that it was.
But that was 2019. I mean, given the career that she had in France, it seems extraordinary that we're only getting really, I'm sure lots of people knew her, maybe who could read it in French, but we're only really getting to hear about her here in the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's all thanks to this little independent publisher called Fitzcarraldo Editions, who started publishing her, as you say, just a couple of years ago. And they've been publishing her work quite regularly. Like, I think they've got about nine books published in translation now, and they're all excellent. They're all really readable. This new one, and the other thing for people who think they are not interested in work in translation, most of them are under 100 pages. They're really, you know, short reads. But this one is as you said, is a kind of selection of journal entries written over the span of about between 1983, I think, and 1992, so 7 years. Sorry, it's 1985. My maths is letting me down there. But they're really random sort of entries, but they actually accumulate to this sense of modern life. You know, there's entries about trolleys, shopping trolleys abandoned, and hairdressers, little snippets from hairdressers, or things overheard on the bus, things seen from the metro, things seen in a free sheet newspaper. And I think we've all sort of, they sound very banal, but actually the reason they hit you on a sort of transcendent level is I think we've all had those moments where we're just sitting on a bus and we're looking at the window and suddenly we understand the meaning of life. Just seeing a little girl with her mother or some very simple scene unfold in front of us, but and yet we can't articulate it the way she does.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, that banality of theme, or seeming banality of theme. How is that dealt with in terms of style?
Well, this, I suppose I have to say that this book is kind of an exception, maybe stylistically, because there are all these like individual, independent entries that are sort of linked through the fact that they're all set in this place where she lives, which is a real suburban new town that sprung up. But stylistically, she writes in this really clear, direct tone. It's, as you said, deceptively simple. But what, in my experience of reading her, what it does, it gives you this really quick, direct access to the emotion that she's writing about. So you're instantly sort of immersed in the work, instantly immersed in what she's describing. Like, she writes in the present tense most of the time, even if she's writing about the past. So you feel like you're in the moment, and she's always trying to get to that crux of the moment as well.
What was happening then between 1985 and 1992, either in this Paris suburb or in the life of Annie Ernaux, given that this does have this autofiction feel to it? What do all these small details add up to in terms of what she's talking about?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because again, this is kind of exceptional for her work, because a lot of her books will be about a moment in her life that was either traumatic or very deep and meaningful. Like, she's written about her father, she's written about her mother's death, her mother's experience with Alzheimer's. She's written a book about her abortion in 1963 as a young student. She's written about an affair she had. So a lot of them are about these momentous moments in her life. This is kind of the opposite. So it's called Exteriors, I think, because obviously a lot of it is set outside, but also she's sort of looking outwards. She's not writing about herself for once in that way. She's looking at other people, at what they're doing, and what it says about us as human beings, essentially. So it's very different from her other work in that way. It's not talking about herself, but we do find out things about her inevitably when we're listening to her describe these people. Like, I found there were several instances where, you know, she's incredibly watchful. Obviously, I found it actually exhausting at parts. I was thinking, my goodness, like, the writer's mind at work here is incredible. A lot of her work does actually deal with the writing process. She talks about it as she writes. Mm. But it's almost like a camera. It's like every single thing she sees is mined to see if there is a kind of literary use for it. And she says that herself, that she's like, constantly looking for can she find that literary use. And it just seems like all writers, I think, will recognise that impulse, but she obviously writes it down. Like, I have this ongoing fear, Sean, that somebody's going to find my notes app in my phone, because my goodness, it's a mess.
Yeah, but I'm sure Annie Ernaux writes it down and then spends a long time getting it into the little pieces that she gives to us to read. But I'm wondering, you know, she rejects, as I said, this whole idea that she is a writer of autofiction. I think it's more that she doesn't want to be boxed into a genre as much as anything else. But do we know it's her? Do we have a sense of whoever this narrator, whoever this person we're reading off on the page, do we know it's Annie Ernaux that's speaking to us? Is that
100%,
what it feels like?
Yeah. 100%. And I think any fans of her work to date will really get a lot from this, will really enjoy it, because it is her eye, it is her filter that we're seeing this, seeing all of these scenes through. She knows what is the salient detail. She knows what is the point that hits home, that is meaningful. So you definitely know it's her. And also, one of her objections to that term autofiction, to being described as a writer of autofiction, is the fiction part of that, because she takes pride in writing everything with extreme accuracy. If she doesn't remember a detail, she will say she doesn't remember, and she will not write about anything that she doesn't remember, or that she doesn't have a kind of a diary entry for, so that she can check. So she's really resistant to being called an autofiction writer because of the fiction part, I think, as opposed to, you know, the fact that she's writing about herself. She gave up writing fiction very early. She wrote three novels, and then it was straight into the autobiography/memoir, life writing, whatever you want to call it.
I like life writing. I'd go with life writing. I like that term. Where do you think then this book, you say that this is kind of slightly different from what we might know of or expect of it. Where does it sit within our body of work?
I think it certainly is representative in terms of the themes that she likes to write about. There's loads on class here. Even just, you know, there's so many scenes where she's either judging the kind of petty bourgeoisie, like people trying to show off that they've got money or that they can afford certain things or that their children are doing piano recitals. And then there's the alternative where she's, you know, watching a scene where a cashier is being castigated by a customer or a manager. And, you know, it all feeds into that class thing where they're seeing as less than.
Final question, Adele. Is this a good starting point? Exteriors, is it a good starting point for reading Annie Ernaux, or would you send us somewhere else?
No, I think it's a brilliant addition to her body of work. But no, go for The Years, which is her defining one, or else go for Simple Passion, a 48-page book on her two-year affair with a married man. I mean, who doesn't love an affair, Sean?
48 pages, I'm loving it already. Thanks very much, Adele. That's Adele Coffey speaking to us about Annie Ernaux's latest publication, in English, that is. It's called Exteriors. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1.